This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. Coming up, we'll hear from Hartford's Asylum Quartet, the first saxophone ensemble to win the International Chamber Music Ensemble competition in Boston. But first, photographer Chris Capozzello has been taking pictures of his twin brother Nick for years. Despite being twins, there was a major difference between these two. Nick was born with cerebral palsy, and Chris was not. The photography of both brothers is featured in this book, The Distance Between Us. Chris's photos show the tough, very painful scenes of seizure-like cramps taking a hold of Nick. They also show some happier, some pain-free times, including scenes of a cross-country road trip that the brothers took together. If you'd like to see some of these photos, go to our website now. It's WNPR.org for a look at what's inside this book. The brothers stopped by our studios to talk about their project. Chris and Nick Capozzello, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
First of all, Chris, why don't you tell us why you embarked on this project, this book, The Distance Between Us?
Well, this is definitely a different sort of story. It's not something I ever set out to do and said, I'm going to photograph my brother. I want to examine this. I started making pictures 13 years ago now when I was a student. And you know, we had professors up at RIT who encouraged us to look at things that are around us, things that we're used to. And so when I would go home on breaks, I would photograph Nick. And so in the beginning, it was a way of practicing. It was a way of, you know, me trying to figure out who I was becoming as a photographer. And so the early pictures were that. It was sort of an exercise in seeing. And as the years went on, I continued to make pictures of Nick. And I would make pictures of us hanging out at family picnics, going out to a bar and having a drink, out front of our house, you know, throwing a tennis ball around. There's actually a picture in the book of I always have my camera over my shoulder, and so we're out front throwing this tennis ball around, and Nick didn't catch it, and he had to run down the street, and there's this photograph of him running towards a car. It looks like the car's gonna hit him. And so, I think that, you know, sometimes pictures mean something different to different people. We have Nick and I and my family have deeper insight, but then someone sees that photograph of Nick being, you know, confronted by this car, and it means something different to them. And, you know, there's a danger, I think, in photography, in that pictures can lie. And so we edit with that in mind. I said before, as like the years went on, I continued to photograph, and I didn't really know why I kept photographing Nick, because as much as I was photographing the happy times, the times when he wasn't in pain, I was also photographing him in pain. And in the middle of it, I couldn't tell you why I was making those pictures, you know, and I'm working as a freelance photojournalist, you know, having to understand why I'm looking at specific things on a daily basis. And then in my other long-form projects that I'm not commissioned to do, but things that I care about looking at and asking questions about, you know. But with my own family and my own brother, and I didn't know why I was taking pictures of him with a cramp. And so, and Nick is sitting here with us right now, and he's fine, you know. But sometimes a cramp will come on, and it's like this transformation of he's able to talk right now, and then slowly he's unable to talk, and his body will lock and contort, and he can't move. And so, you know, I made pictures of Nick during those times, and I didn't know why when I was younger. It was a long process of me answering why I was doing this, and then about 3 years ago, looking at this really like this growing archive of photographs of him, and having to answer to myself, well, why do I have these pictures? Should I share this at all? And that was a long process to come to, because, you know, Nick and I are so much alike, but we're also very different. And there's always an element of pity, and I always had a really hard time dealing with that growing up. The pictures, in a strange way, forced me to deal with these things. And it wasn't anything that was, you know, thought out beforehand. It just turned out to be that way.
Well Nick, I'll ask you, how was it to have your brother first starting to photograph you just as something he was doing to learn his craft, and then more and more as a document of your life and your life together? I mean, how did it feel to have him always there with a camera capturing you when you were good and when you were in pain?
Okay, well, at first, like, I was like, oh, another picture? Jeez, you know, put the camera away.
In the beginning, Nick didn't always like it that I would take pictures, and so sometimes you would turn his head. Or, you know, I have pictures of him with, he's covering his face with a pillow, or in the living room. And is one day, I think I was still a student in undergrad, and I walked into our bedroom. Now, we had bunk beds. And I had the top bunk, though, right? You know, that's better. So I walk in, though, and Nick was sleeping in bed, and he was waking up from a cramp, and the light was just beautiful, and the windows were open, and I came in, and I, you know, as a young photographer, I look at this, and I go, wow, look at this light. And so I bend down with my old Nikon camera, and I take a picture, but the shutter was really loud on those old cameras. And it sort of startled him. And you remember what you did?
I think I hit him in the balls.
Well, no, I was crouched down. You hit me in the face. So I'm sitting there holding my face. Dad hears the camera hit the floor, and, you know, runs into the bedroom, and, you know, says, "Why? You know, he doesn't like when you take pictures of him when he's sleeping. You know, why did you do that?" And, you know, naively, I said, "Dad, look at the light. It's beautiful." And you know, Dad sort of grumbles when he walks out and says, you know, something how I don't, you know, I don't always listen, you know. So that was that was pretty indicative of how Nick felt about the pictures in the beginning, right?
But did it change over time? I mean, did you get more comfortable with him always taking your picture?
I think it was not me getting more comfortable, but it was like more of me just getting used to it, and I was like, why sweat the small stuff? Now that I'm more used to it, it really doesn't bother me.
One of the things that I think is interesting about the book is that it seems as though, and you talk about editing the many, many, many pictures that you took, Chris, it seems as though that there's a really interesting mix of photos that show Nick in pain, in a cramp, in the hospital, and other photos where if you didn't know his story and you didn't know his condition, he would look like, frankly, anybody else on the street. And I'm wondering if you can talk about those choices that you made about that.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, with any story that any of us as journalists work on, you know, we want it to be honest. And so for me, you know, it's been a sort of long journey to see past our differences, you know, because it hurt. It made me feel guilty. And that was something that, like, I mean, we've just recently started talking about that. I mean, I've been sharing this story for a few years, but I never told Nick or my parents that I felt guilty. I've wondered if somehow I'd caused this for him, if I did something in the womb that caused him to not breathe, and that's what happened. And cerebral palsy, you know, in Nick's situation, is an accident of birth. And so I, for a long time, had a hard time looking past, you know, the pain that he was experiencing every day. But I knew that with the pictures that, and with telling his story, you know, he is more than just his disability. And so, you know, I want to be fair with my brother, like I try to be fair with every other story that I work on, and hit different notes of his life, you know, and showing parts of his life that include pain, and then also show parts of his life that include, you know, who he is as a human being, his humor, that extends beyond the pictures and into the text, you know. You know, I'm stuck in a visual world because I'm a photographer and it's my chosen craft, but I think that text is something beautiful and can add so much, you know, to any story. And so, you know, there's a picture of him dancing with this really beautiful woman at a bar in San Juan Capistrano. We were out there a few years ago with some friends, and he's like eyeing this woman all night, you know, the prettiest woman in the bar. And our friend's sister, you know, asks her, you know, would you mind dancing with my friend? And you can tell, you know, we're standing, you know, across the bar, and you can read her body language, and she thinks this is sort of strange. And she says no, but then a few minutes later she agrees. And Nick's dancing with her, and so I don't want it to be an awkward moment, but I make some pictures, you know. I think we have to remember this, you know. And afterwards he walks over and he said, she kept telling me not to look at her feet, but I wasn't looking at her feet. And it's so like, you know, I think that, you know, when we look at people who have disabilities, who struggle, many of us, you know, we get stuck in this sadness for them that they have a life that's different than ours. And I feel this way often. I feel bad for them. I feel terrible. I feel like this isn't how it's supposed to be for them. You know, and they may feel completely different, you know. People with disabilities oftentimes see themselves different than we do. And so I want to make sure that I'm not just using this as an exercise to say, I feel guilty, I feel terrible that this is how it is, but to include those things in order to be honest, but then also balance it with, well, as hard as things might be for Nick, like, he's actually a really funny guy, and he has these awesome, you know, things happen to him with really pretty women at bars, you know, who dance with him. They won't dance with me. They'll dance with him, right? And I think that in the end, like, we have something to gain from that. If we're just too heavy-handed with one aspect of any story, you know, I think that, you know, we fall short, and it's not always honest to do that.
Nick, can you talk about that a little bit? I know you want to pick up on that.
Yeah. There's this one time when I was at Orange Ale House, and I was actually singing a Tim McGraw song, and I knew Chris was taking pictures, and like I basically know all the words, and when it came time to say something like that, I, you know, turned my head and I was saying, you know, something like that, and I was nodding and smiling, and I thought I turned and smiled at him, but it was just like blind hourglass figure girl, and her name was Michelle. I was wearing my cowboy hat, and she came up to me and said, I like your hat. And then she says, now where are your boots? So I told her, I left them at home.
Dude, you're forgetting something major here. She walked up to him and grabbed a hold of his hands and said this to him. I mean, squared off with him and was like, I like your hat, but where are your boots? And
I said to her that I'll wear them, the next time I come down. And so she says, okay. And so the next time I went, she wasn't there. And the whole time we were talking, I could see Chris Roth in the distance, but I was like saying, take a picture, take a picture, take a picture. But he didn't take a picture.
You didn't take a picture of that one.
I didn't. I was standing pretty close to them, and because it was a conversation, and I didn't want her to feel like a spectacle. I didn't want to ruin the moment, you know. That time I didn't, and so it's one of those pictures that I didn't take that I'll always remember, you know.
When we come back from our break, we'll continue our conversation with Chris and Nick Capozzello. You can see some photos from The Distance Between Us on our website, WNPR.org. This is Where We Live. You had a suntan line and red lipstick. I worked so hard for that first kiss, and I'm hard to forget something like that. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. We're listening back to a conversation I recently had with twin brothers Chris and Nick Capozzello. Nick has cerebral palsy, and in Chris's latest book, The Distance Between Us, he chronicles his brother's life and deals with some of his own grief. Now, you can see some of the photographs that we're talking about on our website right now. It's WNPR.org. One of the stories you tell, you mentioned earlier this idea of guilt that you have as a twin without this disability. You write a very powerful passage about an encounter you had at a bar in New Haven, and you talk afterward about shame. And I'm wondering if you can just tell that story briefly
for us and talk about what you mean when you talk about being ashamed? Because it's, I think it's a really important part of the story that you're telling here.
Yeah. So the story in that text was that Nick and I were in New Haven with some friends at a masquerade ball, and so we're in New Haven and Yale's in session, and it's a Friday night, right? It was a Friday night.
A Friday or Saturday.
Yeah.
Something like that.
And we're walking down the street, and you know, whenever we're walking in public, generally, Nick, you sort of lag behind, right? And so I always look over my shoulder. He walks slower than us, and so I'm with my roommate at the time.
And I also have like a weird kind of stagger to myself.
Yeah. And so I turn around to make, you know, see where Nick is, and there's this group of kids outside a pizza joint next to this bar. And when I turn around, I see this one kid who's mimicking the way Nick walks. He's walking right behind him, and he's sort of like rocking his head back and forth the way Nick does when he walks. I mean, it's like Nick said, his walk is sort of staggered, and you know, in that moment, I mean, something in me snapped, and I feel protective of my brother. And you're looking at me. I'm not a tough guy, you know, but something, you know, I've always felt protective over Nick, and I know that. You know, Nick feels the same way about me. He wouldn't want anybody to make fun or hurt me, or, you know, even some of the comments that have come out about this story, Nick has taken some offense to it, you know. At that moment, you know, something snaps, and I get into it with these kids. And as soon as I walk over to them, like I'm surrounded, and the kid that was making fun of Nick is on the outside of this, you know, this crowd, you know, And I don't really remember all that I was saying, but I remember saying something along the lines of, like, would any of you allow someone else to make fun of your crippled brother? And Nick sort of takes offense to cripple because he's not really cripple. But I remember using that word in anger to illustrate to them. And in the middle of that, like, you know, it's a strange thing. You know, anytime you're in sort of a situation where tension is very high, where your head goes. And I remember in that moment, you know, realizing that, like, it's not this kid that I'm really angry at. It's, like, the guilt and the shame that I've carried my whole life. And I think that, you know, it's scary to, you know, I'm sitting next to Nick saying this, and I've read the book and we've talked about this, but the first time I read that to him and to my family, I was scared. You know, how are they going to take that? Because I'm not ashamed of my brother. You know, I'm ashamed of standing next to him, being the healthy twin, the able-bodied twin, you know, and being the example of what life could have been like for him. And that is hard, because as life changes for me, life doesn't change as quickly for Nick. And that's been a hard thing to deal with. And it's something that I didn't want to always talk about. I talk about it with my friends. Those that were close to me, I talk about it with. It's not that I've been denying these things over the years, but to share that, you know, with the journalism community and the community that I work within. Now that means I'm sitting here talking to you about it, and then people are going to listen to this, right? And then I put it in a book and people are going to read that. And some may take offense to that, and I don't want to offend anybody who's, you know, who deals with disability. But the shame was over, you know, the shame I felt was because I live a better life than he does, and I have choices that he doesn't have. And standing next to him, you know, I am that example. The guilt is over having those choices. The guilt is over the fact that I can sling my camera over my shoulder, hop in my car, and go anywhere, and Nick can't drive. And he has different things available to him than I do.
Actually, I want to add on to what he said about not being able to drive. That is wrong. I can drive. It's just I chose not to, because in case I'm driving and I'm on the road and I have a cramp, I don't want to hurt anybody or, at the worst, kill anybody. So that's why I decided it'll probably be better if I don't drive.
If I just clear for one second, I just want to say that about that, and that was his choice. And that for me is a beautiful thing, that Nick made that choice when we were kids, you know, we were teenagers, and he's he's continued to make that choice, you know, that he won't put himself in that situation, not wanting to hurt anybody else. And that, I mean, it's beautiful that he chooses that.
Yeah. Kind of wish I could, but I really don't like relying on other people to drive me around here and there.
Do you feel happy, having seen the book? Do you feel like the book is an accurate representation of your life in some way?
Yeah. I really don't like seeing myself in the situations when I have the cramps, and especially the ones when I'm lying on the floor and those seizure-like cramps. Main thing is, like, I do like the pictures, like, when I'm obviously not having a cramp, like when he talks about before about me running down the street to catch the ball, and the car's coming. It looks like I'm going for a death wish. He's got another picture. It's me lying down on my bed with a hamster.
Yes, it's a beautiful picture.
Yeah, I don't have that one anymore, but I always take him out like all the time, and I play with them all every night. So, because they're nocturnal, so I think take them out at night. Yeah, you know, I want to wake them up to play with them. But
I actually had noted that it's a beautiful, beautiful picture, and you can sort of and you can tell the love that went into it too, into actually taking that exposure of that moment.
Yeah, I mean that, you know, that picture. I made that right before I moved to Mississippi for. It was the second time I moved down there. And, you know, when I made that, I remember, you know, and it's the difference between, like, his perception versus mine, you know, whereas he loves that picture. It made me feel sad.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, because I've felt like for a long time that, like, he's always stuck in that room of ours that we grew up in. And when I made that picture, I left the next day for Mississippi feeling like, well, that's what I'm leaving him with, is his hamsters, you know. And it's a tender moment for sure. But I have, like, initially I had different feelings about it, you know? And so for me, the beginning part of the book, you know, was really, really heavy on, like, my grief and my laments over things being different, you know? And so when when you ask, you know, Nick, do you think that this is an accurate, you know, presentation of what your life is like? You know, for a long time, as I was working through these edits early on, it really wasn't, you know, because it was heavy on my grief, you know. And it wasn't until the last few years that, you know, slowly I started to move past that. And it, you know, when the beginning of the book starts off with, I want answers, you know, mm-hmm. which is, you know, you see someone you love suffer. And most of us, you know, the initial response is, God, why did this happen? You know, why did this horrible thing happen to this wonderful person, right? And so,
you think I'm wonderful?
You know, you're pretty. You're stellar, man. But like, you know, throughout the whole process, and I, you know, I don't want to say, well, like the pictures, you know, did this for me. It made me work on this. In some ways, they did, right? But you know, through the whole process, I started to move past that question. Well, why does this happen to Nick? Why does it happen to anybody? And the questions about, you know, faith and things like that. To like. Asking healthier questions, you know, and I think that coming out on the other side, I think as a whole, I hope as a whole that it's more accurate. I mean, if you saw the like part two and three, I mean, the tone is totally different, you know, and for me, you know, last year when we took that road trip, you know, I mean, I needed that, and I didn't realize how much I needed it at the time, but it was just us out there on the road, like being brothers and goofing off. You know, running around making pictures, and that came after our Papa, our grandfather, had passed away. He'd been at that point, he'd been gone for about a year and a half, and he'd said, you need to make sure that you take care of Nick when Mom and Dad can't anymore. And that's also, like, to even look Nick in the eye right now and like, say it again after having read it to him and talked about it, it's hard because, Nick, you're not incapable, But I know that if I was sick, you would do the same thing for me, and so.
Yeah, sure, I would.
Yeah, and so it's, even for me, like, that was a scary thing to admit. But on the other side of that those hard things came this, okay, well, if there's an answer as to why Nick has cerebral palsy, I don't actually want to know it. If there's some sort of cosmic answer and I found out, well, this is the reason why Nick has suffered and has a harder life than I do, it wouldn't make any sense to me. It wouldn't make me feel any better. And so part two and three of the book is me moving past those questions that I think are very human questions, and it's understandable to have those questions, but they're not helpful, and they're not going to lead you anywhere good. And so, well, what is next for us, I think, is now on the other side of it seems very simple, but it took me a long time to get there, right?
It's funny. The more I talk to you, Chris, this book's really about you, isn't it? I mean, in a lot of ways, it's a lot about a lot of the things that you've been dealing with, too. It's very interesting because, often people think of photography books as books about the subject of those photographs. And this is really something that it seems really helped you get through something. This is a story about your life, too.
Yeah, it is.
Well, yeah, I mean, as the title says, the difference between us.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Come on, John, it's always been about us.
but there's parts of it that are basically telling about, just my experience, and then about other parts are telling about how Chris has to deal with it, and I think that is a really good a really good way that that actually kind of like brought us closer together. I mean, like when we were on the road trip, like for three weeks, we did a lot of stuff together, and we went to a lot of places that we both have never been before. And just to share that experience with each other is something that I will never forget, and I know he won't forget either. And of course, we went to a few other places that we've been to before, but those two were very cherishable memories, and I was taking pictures with my iPod, and like when I would take pictures, I'm glad I was taking pictures with my iPod, but it was something that I think I had to do, because if I didn't, like when I'm old and grayer, I want to look back at these pictures and just be able to remember the good times that we had.
Mm. Well, Nick, your photos, and Chris, your photos, part of this book, The Distance Between Us. Thank you both so much for joining me. I really, really appreciate it. It was great to meet you.
It was good meeting you, too.
Thanks, John.
Coming up next, we'll hear from Hartford's Asylum Quartet, the first saxophone ensemble to win the International Chamber Music Ensemble competition in Boston. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The words classical music and quartet usually mean one thing to people: two violins, viola, and cello, the classic string quartet. But the Asylum Quartet, based in Hartford, is one soprano, one alto, one tenor, and one baritone saxophone. And this quartet just became the first of its kind to win the International Chamber Music Ensemble competition in Boston. In the first installment of a new series we'll be featuring about the arts, the Asylum Quartet stopped by our Studio 3 right here on Asylum Avenue in Hartford to play some of the music that helped them win, and also to play a piece close to our hearts, the Where We Live theme song. Welcome in Joseph Abad, Tony Speranza, Max Schwimmer, and Andrew Barnhart, the Asylum Quartet. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
So first of all, where does the name Asylum Quartet come from?
Actually, right here on Asylum Avenue, coincidentally, which is the street we're on right now. So.
And why? What all brought you together?
Well, we all are from somewhat far away, actually, and we all met as graduate students right here at the Hart School. And we were took a really long time to find a name for the group, and we settled on Asylum.
Yeah, and it's a great name because it has a few different meanings. But I think the whole idea of the saxophone quartet is kind of a new thing to a lot of people. The very idea that a saxophone quartet exists, frankly, is something that a lot of people don't even know. Tell us about the sax quartet as a form.
Well, the sax quartet has been around for a while. It was actually started in the French military bands. It was the saxophone section in the military bands at the end of the 19th century, and it then kind of evolved. The saxophone section from that band would perform separately as a quartet. And throughout the 20th century, it's kind of grown, and there's a lot of it's very prominent in new music. A lot of composers love writing for saxophone quartets because they're so colorful, and because saxophone players just love playing new music and exploring new sounds.
We're talking with the Asylum Quartet today on the program. They recently became the first saxophone quartet to win the International Chamber Music Ensemble competition in Boston. And this is Where We Live. And congratulations on that. That's quite
an
honor.
Thank you.
I mean, this is an unusual thing. Who are you competing against in this competition?
Mostly string ensembles and piano trios and other very established chamber ensembles with long histories. So it was really exciting for us to be involved in something like that as a saxophone quartet, which is a newer ensemble.
A bit later on, we're going to hear a more contemporary piece, but let's listen to a little bit of one of the pieces that you performed. It's a quartet by Alexander Glazunov, and it's a variation on a Chopin piece. Could you talk about this?
Yeah, so the middle movement of this work, which is a much larger work for saxophone quartet, is a theme in several variations, and this is the variation that's influenced by Chopin.
Thank you.
That's the Asylum Quartet. I want to hear another piece that you performed at this competition and that we recorded here. Tell us about this, because as you said, I think a lot of the music for saxophone quartet is more modern music. And this is, I think, a really beautiful, another very kinetic piece that includes a lot of movement and a lot of fast playing.
Yeah. This piece was written by Guillermo Lago. He's a Dutch composer. It was written in 2011, but it's a piece that's growing. It's called Ciudades. The movement is called Cordoba. Other movements in the piece are Sarajevo and Addis Ababa, but I believe he's also added two other movements as of late. So this one is very, very Latin American influence, kind of Spanish influence, just that flavor there, those colors. And it basically indexes his travels with those three cities, and it's been a great process just putting all this together. You'll hear a lot of interweaving among voices and just, as you had mentioned, just communication orally through all these, you know, all these lines and whatnot. So
let's listen to the Asylum Quartet. That's music from Asylum Quartet. They're a saxophone quartet that's playing live in our Studio 3 and speaking with us here on Where We Live. They just became the first saxophone quartet to win the International Chamber Music Ensemble competition in Boston. They met here in Hartford at Hart School, and they take their name from Asylum Hill, where we reside, where we live here on the program. We're going to hear one more piece that you actually worked up special for us that I'm very, very pleased with. But one thing I wanted to ask about was tone. Obviously, in a string quartet, string players have their own sounds and their own ways of playing. But I think to the layman's ear, it's not as distinct as a vocal quartet or certainly a saxophone quartet where you're producing these very, very human sounds. Talk about blending the various tones. If one of the four of you left the group, I'm quite sure it would sound very different, right?
Yeah, that's true. You know, we work a lot on blend and sound, and I think that is one of the things that distinguishes how we sound as opposed to how a jazz saxophone quartet sounds or a string quartet, as you mentioned. But we all have, I think, very similar concepts of sound. We listen to the same recordings, and we've in our training we played the same pieces and had some of the same teachers, and it's just I think it's something we also all play all of the saxophones, so we kind of have some empathy for each other, knowing what we're all going through, basically. So I think we are able to kind of meet each other and create that blend.
I need to ask before we run out of time, what is next for you guys? Because it seems as though you're on this amazing upward trajectory as you're building this career and winning competitions. What do you guys do next?
We are basically trying to, like you had mentioned, gather a lot of steam and momentum here, especially with the New England area. We've got several gigs out of state in Michigan at the Traverse City Film Festival.
We'll be playing at the New Haven International Festival of Arts and Ideas this summer. We're really excited about that.
From what I understand, on the main stage, which will be great. A lot of people get to see that.
Yeah, that'll be cool. And it'll be like the first time we've done something like that. And so I think it's kind of a new thing for a saxophone quartet to do something like that. So we're really excited about those kind of things.
So before we go, we're going to hear one more piece. And, you know, we've been thinking about doing this for years and talking to different musicians about doing this. You worked up a version of our theme song, which is a piece called Flim by Aphex Twin, Richard James. It's been our theme song since the very beginning. We've played variations, jazz variations, that others have recorded, but no one's ever done one specifically to be on the show. So can you just quickly talk about what went into this?
Yeah, we got the email from Lydia here and had a great friend of ours, a composer friend, Ryan Jesperson, who took on the project in a matter of hours, basically. And scored it for four of us, and interesting other sounds. It's been great just putting it all together and really working with Ryan also.
Thanks to the Asylum Quartet for sharing their music with us today. Joseph Abad, Tony Speranza, Max Schwimmer, and Andrew Barnhart. To hear and to see more of the kinetic performance of the Asylum Quartet, go to WNPR.org, where you can find them playing in Cafe Cutie, the little kitchen area on our floor where we live fuels up with coffee. You can also visit their website, asylumquartet.com. Our well-caffeinated staff includes producers Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. Our executive producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankowski, and this is Flim. It's the theme song to Where We Live. It's originally by Aphex Twin, but performed here by the Asylum Quartet on Where We Live. ¶¶